This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Jerry Schechter, KCMO Sustainability Coordinator for the Office of Environmental Quality, will join host Craig Lubo to talk about the 4-star rating KCMO earned and where the city needs to improve. He will talk about the city's movement towards resilience and sustainability and current ordinances that will help the city achieve greater sustainability. But first, I'm Natural E with your headline news. EcoWatch.com reports, there are increasing environmental and health concerns surrounding the oil spill in the East China Sea from the Iranian-registered tanker, the Sanchi, which sank on Monday carrying 136,000 tons, or 1 million barrels, of a highly flammable oil mix called condensate. The tanker had burned for a week before exploding after colliding with another ship on January 6th, with all 32 crew now presumed dead or missing. There are now 4 separate oil slicks of the condensate from the Panama-registered tanker, which together cover over 100 square kilometers, or just under 40 square miles, the same size as Paris, according to a statement by the Chinese State Oceanic Administration released Wednesday. Regarding the ecological impact of the spill, The Guardian reported Thursday that, quote, consumers in Japan, China, and South Korea should be wary of buying seafood until governments in the region have monitored and released details about the toxic impact of the Sanchi oil spill, scientists have warned, end quote. The paper added that, quote, millions of fish are likely to have been contaminated by carcinogens, end quote. However, it's not just fish that are threatened by the spill. As Greenpeace noted, quote, the area is also on the migratory pathway of many marine mammals, such as humpback whale, right whale, and gray whale, end quote. TheGuardian.com reports, on Wednesday, January 10th, city officials announced that New York was to divest its pension funds of about $5 billion in fossil fuel-linked money over the next 5 years. New York's total pension fund for its teachers, firefighters, and other city workers is about $189 billion. Bill de Blasio, New York's mayor, also revealed the city is suing the world's largest oil and gas companies over their role in knowingly creating dangerous global warming in a two-pronged assault that he said is aimed at, quote, standing up for future generations, end quote. Economists said the status of New York as a financial and cultural giant would probably spur other cities in the U.S. and worldwide to divest and, more significantly, build momentum in the global shift required to reduce emissions and stave off the worst consequences of climate change. Quote, this is a really big deal, end quote, said Jeffrey Sachs, an economist at the New York's Columbia University and special advisor to the U.N. Secretary General. He continued, quote, pension funds of other major U.S. cities will follow, I think. New York is the neighborhood of the very big money managers. It's a powerful personal signal to them that they cannot keep funding the sorts of projects they have in the past, end quote. New York will be the first of the U.S.'s largest cities to divest and has jostled to the forefront of a group of global metropolises that have committed to ridding themselves of fossil fuel stocks, including Paris, Berlin, Sydney, and Stockholm. The battle to save the world's coral reefs is at, quote, make or break point, end quote, and countries that host them have a special responsibility to take a leadership role by limiting greenhouse gas emissions, plastic pollution, and impacts from agriculture, the head of the United Nations Environment Program has said, also known as UNEP. Speaking to The Guardian after the launch of International Coral Reef Initiative's International Year of the Reef, Eric Solheim said he expected governments to take their efforts on reef protection in 2018 beyond symbolic designation. Estimates vary, but coral reefs around the world are thought to sustain the lives of about 1 billion people by supporting food sources, protecting coastlines, or providing other economic support. UNEP also announced it would be working in collaboration with WWF to, quote, drive an urgent response to combat the decline of coral, end quote. And finally, EcoWatch.com had some good news to report. In the last several weeks, Oceania and its allies won 5 important victories that will help protect biodiversity and increase abundance in our seas. Belize bans offshore oil drilling in country's marine waters, home to the largest barrier reef in the Americas. Chile bans bottom trawling in 98% of its seas. Canada acts to make the status of its fisheries transparent to its citizens. 21 countries in the EU protect endangered cold water corals throughout the Mediterranean. And the Philippines appoints a special prosecutor to prosecute illegal commercial fishing in the country's largest marine protected area. If you'd like to learn more details about these victories, you can visit our Eco Radio Facebook page where we posted this article. And that's all I have for the news.
Okay. Thank you for joining us here. I do have Jerry Schechter with me. Jerry is the sustainability coordinator with the Office of Environmental Quality for the city of Kansas City, Missouri. And he has been there since December 2006. Before that, he was with the Metropolitan Energy Center, Project Living Proof, and he was there from 2005 to 2006. And then before that, he was executive director of Westside Housing Organization. And at one point, he was had various positions in Kansas City, Missouri, dealing with energy conservation. He's also has served on committees with Bridging the Gap, Riverfront Heritage Trails, and Missouri Commission for Preservation or Prevention of Childhood Lead Poisoning. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Craig. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. And what we're going to talk about this evening is Kansas City, Missouri has achieved and was awarded the four-star sustainability index, and Jerry will tell us what that's all about. There's only two cities in this immediate area that have achieved that, one being Kansas City, Missouri, and the other being Lawrence, Kansas. So let me have you tell us, what is the background of the Star Community Index?
I think I'd like to start real briefly, if I could, with how we sort of got here.
Okay.
I think it's important. Kansas City's been involved in a range of energy efficiency and renewable energy programs literally since the late 1970s. But most recently, beginning under Mayor Barnes, in 2006, the previous city council and the mayor, recognizing that climate change is a critical challenge to us, adopted a resolution supporting a climate protection planning process for Kansas City, Missouri. Since September of 2006, the city's Climate Protection Plan Steering Committee has worked with staff and approximately 100 volunteers representing a broad range of people in the community to develop a climate protection plan for Kansas City, Missouri that was finally adopted in 2008. So we've been working to try and address sustainability and more recently resilience for well over a decade. The Star Community Index is a program that was established really out of the processes at the Urban Sustainability Directors Network, which is an organization of cities and some counties that are addressing sustainability in a really broad sense all across the country. The system, the Star Community Index, which means the sustainability tools for assessing and rating communities, was developed for local governments by local governments about 6 years ago. And in that time, about 100 cities have begun to use the index, the process. It's a it's the nation's first comprehensive framework and certification program for evaluating local sustainability. There are many in different interpretations, I guess, of sustainability, and the STARS Community Index definition is really very broad, trying to take into consideration the kinds of activities that are appropriate for one city but may not be appropriate for another. As an example, Miami has to be very concerned about rising oceans. We don't. In Kansas City, we have to be more concerned about rising heat projected over time. So it allows communities to credibly track their progress toward overall sustainability objectives and allow communities to compare progress with themselves. So we benchmark ourselves and see where we're going, and then to compare ourselves in progress against other cities and counties around the country.
And there's two terms that you used, and if you could explain a little bit about the difference if somebody's not familiar with them, I think everybody knows what sustainability is, but you also use the term resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what the difference is between those?
My perspective, resilience is one of the things that is required to achieve sustainability. Resilience really, at its base, is the ability to get back up after you've had some kind of a major event. So Houston got flooded. What are they going to be doing to recover from the floods? That is a measure of their resilience, as an example. We have more tornadoes here or ice storms. Question is, how do we respond to those kinds of things? And it's not just those specific events, but it's climate change addresses events over a long period of time, as opposed to single events that may take an hour, like a tornado, that are very quick in nature. So it's a combination of those kinds of things, short-term and long-term approaches to how do we respond to critical events.
And this organization that's doing the ratings, is that a government agency or a private organization?
It is a private organization, and the membership is made up mostly cities all across the country, but it is a private organization in that regard.
And do the cities have to request to be rated, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's not something that the Star Community Index would come in and just impose upon us. Each city requests to enter the process after reviewing what's necessary. We requested that about a year and a half ago. It took us about a year to actually complete the process to submit our application. It's a very, very involved application, and then it's reviewed by a group of independent third-party interviewers who assign assign points to what we've submitted in our application.
And what are the factors that they look at?
There are seven overall goals, which are broad sustainability themes with community-level aspirations, I guess. Flowing from those seven goals, there are 44 objectives, which are really subcategories that move the community toward any particular goal. As an example, there might be a goal of addressing the built environment. One of those 44 objectives would be housing affordability, as an example. So it's looking at how we achieve those kinds of things, and it looks at 108 different outcome measures and 408 different action measures that result in 516 measures that are used to evaluate how we're doing. The seven overall goals include the built environment. It includes climate and energy, economy and jobs, education, arts, and the community, equity and empowerment, health and safety, and natural systems. And each one of those has sets of measures within those general categories.
And the natural systems, what's the distinguishing factor? Because it seems like that obviously would seem to overlap with the built environment and the climate and energy.
Sure. If you look at each one of these elements, there is absolutely overlap among them. But the objectives that are included under natural systems are green infrastructure, invasive species, natural resources protection, outdoor air quality, water in the environment, and working lands like farms and the like. So that's what's defined nationally as natural systems.
Okay. And sustainability, then, it's referring to more than just the environment.
Absolutely. We refer to it as a three-legged stool. It's economic vitality, environmental stewardship, and social equity. Social equity is a critical issue.
And those seven goals, are those all weighted the same?
Or? No, they're not.
Okay, so how do they weight those?
I don't have the specific relative weights of all the points, all the individual goals and objectives. Those are all, I think they're available online, but I don't have those specifically.
So, and the city got 4 stars, as did yes. Lawrence. Is that the maximum, or is it?
No, it's a series. There's 3 stars, 4 stars, and 5 stars.
Okay.
And the points that the independent assessors look at, anything up to 399 points is a 3-star range. Up to 599 is a 4-star range, and anything 600 points and over is a 5-star range.
And is there a plan to address some of the things that can be done to perhaps increase that to a 5-star rating?
Yeah, most communities have taken their rating and looked at both the pluses and the minuses, where they've done well and where they have not done quite as well, and defined for themselves what those kinds of things that it would take to not only raise the rating, but overall move more towards sustainability as a community, and to be a healthier, more vibrant community, in which is really the overall goal.
And you said social equity is one of them, and I'm not sure what the subtopics would be in that, but does that include, what are the non-environmental things that that might include?
Equity and engagement and empowerment include civic engagement in all parts of the community. It includes civil rights and human rights. It includes environmental justice, equitable services and access to those services, human services in a much broader sense, and poverty prevention and alleviation. Those are the critical categories within the social equity component directly.
All right. And is the city looking at, in terms of the economic factors, how that impacts on the environment? In the sense that it might be hard to get somebody in the inner city to think about doing some of the things, whether it's recycling or just to even think about climate change because they're worried about how they're going to eat their next meal in some
places. I think you've hit it on the head. That's a real critical issue is how we engage people at all levels of the community, and it hasn't been done well in any community in the country virtually. I should say that we've done well in many of the categories. Our worst category is equity and empowerment. That is a critical issue for Kansas City, but even though that's our worst, the worst score that we received. We're still above the national average, or the national median, I should say. And we're above the national median in every category, but our down point, something that we have to work on over time, is, in fact, social equity issues.
Okay. And what are some of the cities that you're aware of that have achieved the 5-star, and have you looked at what they did to reach the 5-star and what Kansas City, Missouri might be able to do to get to that same point?
Well, there's only 4 cities that have achieved 5-star rating. Baltimore, Maryland, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Seattle, Washington, and Northampton, Massachusetts. Those are the only 4. I should say that there are 27 out of the about nearly 100 that are using the system. There are 27 that have achieved a 4-star community rating, which, as we've indicated, Kansas City is one of those 27. Those are very the 5-star rating cities are very diverse. They have a lot of issues that we don't have. Baltimore, as an example, has thousands of vacant properties, much more so than we have. Lots of vacant structures, as well as being having to be concerned with oceans rising. We don't have the problems in the same way that Baltimore does. One of the other cities is Seattle. we don't have problems in the same way that necessarily Seattle does. So it's very hard to say what's good for Seattle or what's good for Baltimore would also be good for Kansas City. Certainly, we are looking at all of those five-star cities as well as the other four-star cities to try and understand what has worked for them. I agree with you there that that's important to do, but it's also important to understand that how we need to approach things here may be very different.
Okay. And I think we're ready for our first break. When we come back, we will take phone calls, and the number is 816-931-5534.
Supporting KKFI, Folk Alliance International, presenting the 2018 Kansas City Folk Festival. Family-friendly with artists from around the region and around the globe, featuring headliner Mary Chapin Carpenter. Sunday, February 18th at the Westin Crown Center in Kansas City. For information and advance tickets, kansascityfolkfestival.org.
What else is there but the voice inside your heart? Something tame, something wild.
Hi, I'm Tom Crane, host of KKFI's World Sound Radio and president of Friends of Community Media as a co-sponsor. Mark this event on your calendar. On Thursday, January 25th at 5 p.m., there will be the 4th KKFI Ascertainment Community Forum, 39th and Main, rear door. A great program is planned, and meet and greet our special guests and network with them. That's January 25th, 5 p.m. at KKFI.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Canada's vast conifer forests are being destroyed by tiny beetles that are on the move. Mountain pine beetles are native to Western North America. But as the climate warms, the beetle's range is expanding.
It's actually jumped the Rockies and has spread across Alberta to Saskatchewan. That's in the far north. It's interior. It's typically very, very cold. And in the past, too cold for the beetle to survive there. But now it's warm enough.
Diana Six is an entomologist at the University of Montana. She says that as the beetles spread to these new locations, they are starting to kill a new type of tree, jackpine, which is a dominant species across much of Canada.
Jackpine is what we call a naive host. It means it's one that the beetle hasn't co-evolved with, and so that tree has never had to evolve defenses against the beetle.
She fears that the beetles could destroy vast areas of jackpine forests across Canada, and eventually even move into eastern pine forests. When dead trees decompose, they release stored carbon back to the atmosphere. So when millions of trees are destroyed by beetles, it's not just devastating for wildlife. It makes climate change worse.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Okay, we're back with Jerry Schechter from the Office of Sustainability in Kansas City, Missouri. And we're talking about sustainability and the four-star community rating that they received about a year ago, right?
Right.
Okay. And we will take phone calls now, so if you want to call, we have you can call with questions or comments, 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. What are some of the major environmental things that they look at to rate the sustainability?
Environmental things are again, that's one of those categories that spreads not very neatly and very, you know, can't be defined very, very specifically, because there's the built environment, there's climate, there's energy, those kinds of things. I think climate and energy is very much one of those things that people would think about. That would include climate adaptation, how we accommodate climate change. It would include greenhouse gas mitigation, in other words, how we reduce the noxious gases that what we do puts into the atmosphere. greening the energy supply, a movement from fossil fuels to renewable fuels, dealing with resource efficiency in the industrial sector, building efficiency, public infrastructure efficiency, waste minimization, would be recycling and reuse and those kinds of things. So it's a fairly broad category, and it does spill over into the built environment. As you said earlier, it's kind of hard to sometimes totally segregate any one of these objectives from another. But in sustainability, one of the things that I think is important that we keep in mind is we're not trying to deal with things exclusive and extracted from their context. We're trying to deal with things in a way that we're, if you will, connecting the dots. So we're trying to see those interconnections and trying to understand how we move in one direction and what the ripple effect is, that what our actions have, how we can make better actions with less negative impact.
And one of the things I think that is probably stands out most as far as what a local city can do would be their transportation system and mass transit. What is Kansas City, Missouri doing in the long run? Are there plans other than just adding buses? I think Kansas City is probably one of the few cities that doesn't seem to have anything like a commuter rail or anything for a city of this size. Is there anything going on with that? I know at one point it was put to a vote when Clay Chastain was here, and I think they passed something, but I don't know that anything really happened other than the streetcar between Union Station and City Market.
People other than myself determined that there were some major issues with what was passed, and addressed it in a direct fashion by not doing what that particular plan proposed. We've got the light rail system, the streetcar system here in Kansas City. There's been discussions about whether or not to expand it. I know the Streetcar Authority, which is in fact independent of the city, as the Kansas City Area Transportation Authority is independent of the city. The Streetcar Authority is looking to expand at this point north down to Berkeley Riverfront Park, as well as possibly south toward Brookside and UMKC. So those things are being looked at. Connectors, there was a change that was made a couple of years ago in the administration of the various different bus lines, so that all the bus lines in Kansas City and Independence and across the state line into Johnson County, they're coordinated now in a way that they were never coordinated before. So there's movement that's being made there. The powers that be at the Ride KC, they're looking at more efficient buses. There's been a big movement toward compressed natural gas. There's now looking at electric buses. So there's a lot of movement in that direction. Certainly contributing to that would be the bike share program that was installed here in Kansas City, the various ride hailing services. All of those contribute to people being able to be transported around the city in ways that hopefully are more rational over time, that get to interconnectedness, if you will, over time.
You mentioned compressed natural gas.
Yes.
What about, are they looking at hydrogen at all?
We have not been directly looking at hydrogen so far. We've, in many respects, adopted a compressed natural gas as our interim fuel. Mm-hmm. The Kansas City, Missouri itself has a very large fleet, about 2,500 or so vehicles. A significant percentage of those are compressed natural gas, and a growing percentage is electric. So we're making a transition. We're looking at what we can afford to do. I mean, quite frankly, electric vehicles are more expensive than what we're used to spending on vehicles. But that's changing over time. There are a lot. The battery packs are less expensive now than they were a number of years ago. We've partnered with Kansas City Power and Light and installed a large number of electric vehicle charging stations. Kansas City Power and Light had a target of installing 1,000 charging stations in the region. Kansas City, Missouri has installed 96 charging stations on public property in parking facilities and other places, off-street parking facilities and other places. So,
and those are independent of the ones KCPL is going to install? Or
no, they're part of the same network.
Okay.
The network that Kansas City Power and Light instituted. We made a decision to become part of that network and have, like I said, installed about 96 charging stations around the city on public property.
Okay. But their goal is still to have 1,000?
As far as I know, charging. Yes.
Okay.
And we're one of the fastest, according to Power and Light Company, we're one of the fastest growing markets for electric vehicles in the country right now.
Okay. And the light rail, we talked about the potential expansion in different directions. Is there any long-range plan that the light rail authority has in mind to expand to go to the airport?
Not that I've heard of at this particular point. A major difficulty is getting across the rivers. There's certainly railroad bridges that go across the river, but we don't have access to those, nor do they. The Streetcar Authority doesn't have access to that. Mm-hmm. So at this point, there's part of the extreme cost of going north to the airport would be crossing the river, building a bridge that would handle the streetcar traffic or other traffic as well, okay. whether light rail or whatever.
Okay, and light rail and commuter rail might be a possibility now.
All right, and I know it's been looked at, but there are significant issues at this point have caused us to look for expansion in a narrower band at this point. So we're looking at going north on Grant to the park, going south on Main Street to...
Are they looking at the possibility that if they go to the airport that a lot of that cost might be offset by having more convention business?
I can only assume there. I'm not in the planning group that's dealing with that. My personal assumption is that would be part of the analysis.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about environmental justice. What is being done on that front?
I think it has to come down to engagement. One of the things that has been of concern to a number of people has been the inability for a number of things to engage a significant part of the community, especially low and moderate income community in the core city with environmental issues. There's environmental justice issues that are in the core, whether it be old gas stations that have tanks maybe underground or that could be leaking, or whether it be dumping in the core city, people dumping tires on vacant lots. Those things are part of what addressing environmental justice involves. I know that the city has several thousand lots. It's a dynamic number because lots go into the tax process on a regular basis. The city tries to address the issues of vacant lots in a number of different ways, part of which is it's not just vacant lots, but it's vacant properties. There are houses out there that are vacant and attractive for problems. Attractive to problems. Mm-hmm. So it's addressing that. We have a land bank which is dealing with the properties on an ongoing basis. We're working with the county, working with The Urban Homestead Authority, which also is a repository for vacant properties, to try and address that. You've seen in the news over the last couple of years efforts to get structures, vacant structures that are dilapidated but and in need of repairs, out to people for very low cost, where people have to agree to renovate the properties. So it's part of the process of dealing with that. There are those kinds of ranges of issues that that are included in the environmental justice concept.
Okay. And what about things like bicycle lanes? Is that a big part of the ratings?
Yes, it is. How bike-friendly the community is in fact part of the rating. Since this rating was done before we started installing some of the bike lanes along Grand Avenue downtown, we did not have any, so it counted against us. We could not get points for what we had not done. We had things in planning, certainly, and we get points for planning, but we had no outcomes at that particular point. The rating process recurs every 3 years, so I'm making an assumption that when we enter the rating process again in 2 years from now, that where we've come with regard to things like bike lanes will help us, will show in the ratings that we get. But they were not part of the rating before because we did not have them.
And do they look at just what the city is doing or what private business does too? And what I'm thinking of is last week we had on Jeremy Knoll talking about LEED certification and other things relating to that. A lot of that would be private buildings getting LEED certified. Do they look at that in rating the city?
Absolutely. There's one whole set of goal areas that is just built environment, and that would play very heavily in that. I don't know if Jeremy gave you the statistic or not, but we're among the top cities in the country, top regions in the country, I should say, for ENERGY STAR certified buildings. That was a surprise to us when the federal government released its ratings, a pleasant surprise nonetheless. So we've got quite a few buildings that have ENERGY STAR rating. Whether or not they're LEED certified is a different issue, but that is very, very important. And we did relatively well in that category because of things like that.
I was going to ask you, what is the difference between ENERGY STAR ratings and LEED certification?
LEED certification is a rating system in and of its own, where there are certain activities that if you choose to do on the buildings that you're building or renovating, that you can get certain points for achieving certain levels, whether it's LEED Silver or LEED Gold or LEED Platinum. Each one of those is discrete certifications that are possible. ENERGY STAR is more so concerned with energy efficiency more directly, as opposed to LEED, which is much broader. ENERGY STAR means that if you reach a certain level using what's called the Portfolio Manager system, which is a free system online that has been implemented a number of years ago by the Environmental Protection Agency, building owners and managers can benchmark their own buildings and determine where they stand from an energy efficiency perspective. They get a rating. They look at not only what's called the energy use intensity, which is energy use per square foot or per some parameter like that, and if they achieve a rating in that system of 75 points or better, then they're eligible for ENERGY STAR certification. But it's a system that addresses more energy efficiency directly than the LEED system. LEED includes energy efficiency and renewable energy, but it includes a lot more beyond that.
And let's look at recycling programs. Is the participation rate high in Kansas City, Missouri? I live on KCK, and I think it's only about 50% or less.
It is less in Kansas City, Missouri. Our participation rate, although I don't know the exact number, it's in the range of about 30%, maybe a little bit less. I'd have to find that very specifically, but we need to improve there quite a bit.
All right, and we are ready to take our second break, and we'll be back in a moment.
This is jazz singer Queen Bey from Kansas City, Kansas.
This is Calvin Arsenia, your friendly neighborhood harpist.
Hey, this is Kelly Hunt.
Hi, I'm Connie Dover.
I'm Bob Walkenhorst.
I'm Chuck Haddix, and you're listening to 90.1 FM.
KKFI.
Kansas City Community Radio.
KKFI is the voice of the community. You can amplify that voice and yours by going to kkfi.org/donate.
That sound, you ask?
It's the sound of one-time-use trash. People get bottled water because of hydration, convenience, and the claim of better taste and quality. Truth is, there's usually no difference between bottled and tap water. The healthier choice is to get a cool, reusable bottle made of lined aluminum, steel, glass, or special plastic that won't break off chemical bits like the plastic used in disposable bottles. Get healthy and keep your world from becoming a big junk pile. Disposables dead. Brought to you by J.C. Herman High School and 90.1 FM KKFI.
Saving water while traveling on today's Current Cast. Hotels and motels use a lot of water, but it's not all within their control. According to Tara O'Hare of the EPA's WaterSense program, guests are responsible for about 30% of a hotel's total water use. To conserve, she suggests travelers take the same steps they do at home. Keep their showers short and turn off the faucet while brushing their teeth.
Guests can also keep their thermostat at a moderate temperature to reduce the energy and water needed to heat and cool their rooms.
Ask at the front desk if the hotel has a towel and linen reuse program. Participating reduces the water used for laundry and gives a whole new meaning to the term traveling light. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Okay, thank you for staying with us, and we are talking to Jerry Schechter from the Sustainability Office in Kansas City, Missouri. And if you have a question or comment, we do still have time for one to two calls. You can call us at 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. So let's talk about to sum things up some. Put everything together. What does all this mean? Significance of the community index and the star rating for the city and for the environment.
Well, hopefully for the environment, it means that we are making better decisions in terms of addressing some of those issues, some of the goals and objectives that are identified in. That we want to get points in. I think the significance of the Star Community and Rating Index is that it's a way for us to benchmark ourselves, to understand where we are now, to try and understand where we have shortcomings that need to be addressed, and to find ways to do that. I think it's understanding that climate change is an enormous challenge for us, and it's a defining issue for our time, and that we need to find creative and aggressive ways to deal with it.
All right. And there's a resolution that you mentioned, I guess, in the city. What is that about?
Yeah. In August, City Council of Kansas City, Missouri passed Resolution Number 170586, which was in the resolution itself is referred to as the Renewable Energy Now Resolution. We kind of refer to it as the Clean Energy Resolution. It directs staff, the city manager and staff, which includes the office that I'm in, to, in consultation with the Climate Protection Steering Committee, and other key stakeholders, employers, financial institutions, et cetera, we're directed to evaluate the feasibility of implementing 10 initiatives. And I think it's critical for us, the 10 initiatives, if I could just take a moment to tick them off real quickly. One is determining whether or not the city itself, that's the municipal operations, can go 100% renewable energy within 3 years. Second is whether or not we can bring 90% of municipal buildings over 25,000 square feet into Energy Star certification, which we talked about earlier. And both of those involve challenging others in the private sector and nonprofits to do the same. Developing an energy efficiency initiative for employees of the city. So through the city system, our employees could get access to energy efficiency measures as an employee in some fashion, and challenging others to do the same. There are
when
two.
When you say that, you talk about access at their in their homes.
It would be access through the work environment that would allow them to do energy efficiency improvements and renewable energy improvements in their homes. Yes. We've got two critical ones that are developed that are directed to the community. One of which is developing an initiative to increase energy and water efficiency, solar and electric vehicle use in underserved communities. That is very directly a social equity issue. Developing a strategy for increasing customer interest in financing. Developing five community solar facilities around the community. We have a nonprofit in the community that is leading the way on that. It's Westside Housing is already well into its process for trying to determine whether or not they can do a community solar project. And it's very dependent upon Kansas City Power and Light and the Missouri Public Service Commission as to whether or not something like that could even occur. Another one is requiring the disclosure of energy efficiency and renewable energy features for a developer who wanted to get some kind of incentives, whether it's tax increment or some other kind of incentive. They might get bonus points, if you will, for doing energy efficiency improvements in their design, in their plan. We're looking at developing an electric vehicle purchasing plan and consortium. Implementing a citywide plan to synchronize traffic signals and developing a program of training for municipal building code inspectors and private residential and commercial building staff to achieve 75% energy code compliance. Every one of those 10 initiatives has a time frame on it, and we have a report that we're working on that has to be back to City Council on feasibility assessment by March 1st. Okay. So that's all in the way of the STAR Community Index. So what? What are you doing about it? These are the kinds of things that we are currently doing about it.
And one of those things was to achieve renewable, 100% renewables within 3 years.
Yes.
Is that on track? Is it feasible?
We don't know if it's feasible yet. Part of it is it's tied up with what the utilities do because of rules and regulations established by the Public Service Commission. We know that Ameren, a company on the east side of the state, has already trying to get that kind of a program established on the east side, and Kansas City Power and Light Company is looking at filing a similar application here to get that on the west side of the state to make it easier for us to do something like that.
All right. And the five, you referred to five solar projects, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be, you talked about something similar to what I've heard called solar farms?
Yes.
All right.
It's very similar to that.
Okay, so we're just about out of time. And if you will, after the show, if you can give me some websites that would be good for people to look at, and I can include that on our website. And so I want to thank, for those just joining us, we've been talking to Jerry Schechter, who is the Sustainability Coordinator for Kansas City, Missouri. And specifically, we were talking about the 4-star rating by the Community Index STAR rating system. So I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. This is Natural E again with your events. Friday, January 26th, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., there's a beekeeping class, and this is a free event. It's in Harrisonville, Missouri, at the Family Center Farm and Home. Family Center Farm and Home is excited to offer another great and free class from beekeeper and educator Patty Now. Attendees will learn how to get started in beekeeping, the history of bees, why honeybees are important, how honeybees affect our society, and much more. Families are welcome, and they would like to know if you will be going by clicking on the going button in their Facebook event, which we have posted to our Eco Radio Facebook page. On Wednesday, January 31st, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Fossil Free Fast Campaign kickoff at Spokes Cafe and Cyclery at 1200 Washington Suite B. You're welcome to join them on January 31st for the Fossil Fuel Fest, the Climate Resistance Live Event Watch Party in downtown KCMO. This is the kickoff for a nationwide campaign to build power at the local level to make a rapid and just transition to 100% clean energy, and it's your chance to meet others in your community who want to organize to take climate action. The live stream itself begins at 7 p.m., but you're welcome to arrive as early as 6 p.m. to meet and mingle with other climate justice advocates beforehand. For those who are able and interested in staying, the organizers will also stick around after 8:30 to facilitate discussions about getting fossil-free resolution campaigns started in the area municipalities. And finally, on Sunday, February 11th, Wild and Scenic Film Festival 2018. This event takes place at the Blue Note in Columbia, Missouri. It's the Traveling Wild and Scenic Film Festival, and it's their annual friend and fundraiser for Missouri River Relief. The doors open at 1 p.m., music starts at 1:30 p.m., and the films will be shown from 2 to 5 p.m. They will have details coming soon if you visit them online at riverrelief.org.
How the shutdown affects environmental protection. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
A common pattern is emerging in different parts of the world. Global warming is leading to water shortages that in turn lead to civil unrest and sometimes war.
Nigeria, Somalia, and Syria have all had problems with drought and serve as a warning about what can happen in water-stressed areas.
Little or no water can make people migrate to urban areas, resulting in joblessness and discontent. Drought has forced young men in parts of Africa to move and join insurgencies such as Boko Haram. Dry conditions contributed to migrations in Syria, leading to its civil war.
The New York Times reports that Iran may be the latest to follow the pattern. Last December, protesters showed up in a rural area to demonstrate against water transfers to urban centers.
They shouted "Death to the dictator," the same chant heard in later demonstrations around Iran when 21 people died and hundreds were arrested.
According to the LA Times, analysts say an overlooked factor in the recent demonstrations is the impact of climate change and the widespread perception that Iran's leaders are mishandling a growing problem of water scarcity.
96% of the country's land area has experienced prolonged drought conditions, according to the Iranian news agency.
The World Resources Institute says that 33 countries will face water stress by 2040, with those in the Middle East and North Africa at the highest risk.
An expert who spoke to the New York Times said that the water crises don't lead straight to conflict, but can be a catalyst, the thing that breaks the system.
A new study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that bacteria causing Legionnaires' disease are found in the water systems of buildings not just in isolated areas, but nearly everywhere in the country.
The disease is a severe and often lethal form of pneumonia. Every year, as many as 18,000 people are infected, and since 2000, reported cases have risen sharply.
As reported in Circle of Blue, researchers took water samples at nearly 200 cooling towers in almost all areas of the U.S. About half of the samples were positive for living bacteria, which are frequently found in heating and air conditioning systems of apartments, hospitals, hotels, or similar buildings.
A humanitarian group in Tucson reported last week that U.S. Border Patrol agents have routinely emptied water containers and removed supplies left in the southern Arizona desert for migrants.
Various organizations leave water jugs for migrants coming from Mexico into Arizona. Removing them could cause some of them to die, according to a member of the group No More Deaths, which did the report.
The study showed over 400 water containers were smashed from 2012 to 2015. The report says those likely to have committed the vandalism are Border Patrol agents. Volunteers made video recordings of some of the officers emptying jugs in the desert last year.
The report also acknowledges that it's possible hunters, militia groups, and animals destroyed some of the water containers and other supplies.
A spokesperson for U.S. Customs and Border Patrol told the news outlet Fronteras that the agency does not condone or encourage the destruction or tampering with water or food products.
Between 2012 and 2015, a local county medical examiner collected the remains of almost 600 people who died trying to cross the border, and that number has risen steadily since 2014.
The EPA is taking steps to roll back regulations that prohibit children under the age of 18 from using dangerous chemicals on the job.
Last month, the agency formally announced that it was reviewing the rule mandating that only adults can spray and handle chemicals on farms.
And in addition, the EPA may allow children who work with pest control companies and others to use highly restricted compounds such as arsenic and methyl bromide.
A former EPA official who worked on the current restrictions told the Huffington Post that there's a pretty strong likelihood that if the minimum age is eliminated or lowered, there will be more people getting sick. He noted that with some of the pesticides, only a teaspoon of the chemicals can kill a person.
Many of the children who are intended to be protected by the age limits are migrants who speak limited English. An organization of pediatricians that supported the age limits when they were put in place said that children under the age of 18 are still developing, and many pesticides are highly toxic to their brains and reproductive systems.
And finally, speaking of government agencies, because Congress wasn't able to reach an agreement on the federal budget, the U.S. government has been forced into a partial shutdown. So what does that mean for public health and the environment?
Starting with the EPA, National Geographic reports that, according to a current contingency plan, more than 94% of the agency's workforce would be placed on enforced leave.
That means non-emergency work would stop. According to CNN, during the 2013 shutdown, inspections at about 1,200 drinking water systems, chemical facilities, and hazardous waste sites were put on hold.
EPA says it will maintain Superfund projects that would pose an imminent threat to human life, such as ones that could contaminate drinking water.
But at NOAA, the U.S. Department of Commerce estimates that only about half of its 12,000 employees would be placed on leave during a shutdown because many of them are considered necessary to protect human life and property. Research, however, would be shuttered.
Also, according to CNN, the Food and Drug Administration would have to cancel routine health and safety inspections to find potential problems from foodborne illnesses. During the 2013 shutdown, the FDA delayed nearly 850 safety inspections of food and feed.
The Trump administration will try to keep national parks open with limited staff. However, campgrounds, full-service bathrooms, and other amenities will be closed.
And it cannot be overlooked that the uncertainty and stress of not knowing when they'll get back to work and collect a paycheck could harm the health of government employees.
That's all for This Week in Water. We'll see you next time. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.